at brake bills. It fixed him here and nowhere else. It wasn't a fantasy. It was flesh and blood. And she understood that. She seemed to know everything about Quentin, everything he was thinking and feeling, sometimes before he did. And she wanted him in spite of it, because of it. Together they rudely colonized the upstairs at the cottage, running back to the dorms only for indispensable personal items and letting it be known that trespassers would be exposed to displays of mutual affection, verbal and otherwise, and the sight of their scattered underthings. That wasn't the only miraculous event that summer. Astoundingly, the three older physical kids had graduated from break bills. Even Josh with his lousy grades. The official ceremony would happen in another week. It was a private affair to which the rest of the school were not invited. By tradition, they would be allowed to stay at break bills for the rest of the summer, but after that, they would be ushered out into the world. Quentin was stunned by this turn of events. They all were. It was hard to imagine life at break bills without them. It was hard for Quentin to imagine life after break bills at all. There hadn't been much discussion of what they were going to do next, or at least not around Quentin. It wasn't necessarily a cause for alarm. The passage from break bills to the outside world was a well-traveled one. There was an extensive network of magicians operating in the wider world, and being magicians, they were in no danger of starving. They could do more or less whatever they wanted, as long as they didn't interfere with one another. The real problem was figuring out to their own satisfaction what that was. Some of the student body went into public service, quietly promoting the success of humanitarian causes or subtly propping up the balance of various failing ecosystems or participating in the governance of magical society, such as it was. A lot of people just traveled or created magical artworks or staged elaborate sorcerous war games. Others went into research. Many magical schools, although not breakbills, offered programs of postgraduate study, with various advanced degrees conferred at the end. Some students even chose to matriculate at a regular non-magical university. The application of conventional science, chemistry especially, to magical techniques was a hot field. Who knew what exotic spells you could create using the new transuranic elements? "I was thinking of trying to talk to the Thames Dragon about it," Elliot said airily one afternoon. They were sitting on the floor in the library. It was too hot for chairs. "The who?" Quentin said. "You think he would see you?" Josh asked. "You never know till you ask." "Wait a minute," Quentin said. "Who or what is the Thames Dragon?" "The Thames Dragon," Elliot said. "You know, the dragon who lives in the Thames. I'm sure he has another name, a dragon name, but I doubt we could pronounce it." "What are you saying?" Quentin looked around for help. "An actual dragon? Are you saying there are real dragons?" He hadn't quite reached the point where he always knew when he was being made fun of. "Come on, Quentin," Janet scoffed. They'd gotten to the part of push where they flipped cards across the room into a hat. They were using a mixing bowl from the kitchen. "I'm not kidding." "You really don't know? Didn't you read the McCabe?" Alice looked at him incredulously. "It was in Mirk's class." "No, I did not read the McCabe," Quentin said. He didn't know whether to be angry or excited. "You could have just told me there were real dragons." She sniffed. It never came up. Apparently there really were such things as dragons, though they were rare, and most of them were water dragons, solitary creatures who rarely broke the surface and spent a lot of their time asleep, buried in river mud. There was one, no more, in each of the world's major rivers, and being smart and practically immortal, they tended to stash away all kinds of odd bits of wisdom. The Thames dragon was not as sociable as the Ganges dragon, the Mississippi dragon, or the Neva dragon, but it was said to be much smarter and more interesting. The Hudson River had a dragon of its own. It spent most of its time curled up in a deep, shadowy eddy less than a mile from the Brakebill's boathouse. It hadn't been seen for almost a century. The largest and oldest known dragon was a colossal white who lived coiled up inside a huge freshwater aquifer under the Antarctic ice cap, and who had never once in recorded history spoken to anyone, not even its own kind. "But you really think the Thames dragon is going to give you free career advice?" Jarz said. "Oh, I don't know," Elliot said. "Dragons are so weird about these things. You want to ask them deep, profound questions like, where does magic come from, or are there aliens, or what are the next 10 Marsen primes? And half the time they just want to play Chinese checkers." "I love Chinese checkers," Janet said. "Well, okay, maybe you should go talk to the Thames dragon," Elliot said irritably. "Maybe I will," she said happily. "I think we'd have a lot to talk about." Quentin felt like all the physical kids were falling in love with each other, not just him and Alice, or at least with who they were when they were around each other. In the mornings they slept late. In the afternoons they played pool and boated on the Hudson and interpreted each other's dreams and debated meaningless points of magical technique. They discussed the varying intensities and timbres of their hangovers. There was an ongoing competition, hotly contested, as to who could make the single most boring observation. Josh was teaching himself to play the rinky-tink upright piano in the upstairs hallway, and they lay on the grass and listened to his halting rendition of Heart and Soul over and over and over again. It should have been annoying, but somehow it wasn't. By this point they had thoroughly co-opted the butler, Chambers, who regularly furnished them with extra special bottles from the Brakebill's cellars, which were overcrowded anyway and needed to be drunk up. Elliot was the only one with any real sophistication in enological matters, and he tried to teach the rest of them, but Quentin's tolerance was low, and he refused to spit as a matter of principle, so he just ended up getting drunk every night and forgetting whatever he was supposed to be learning and starting over from scratch the next night. Every morning when he woke up, it seemed impossible that he could ever consume another drop of alcohol, but that conviction had always evaporated by 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Emily Greenstreet. One afternoon, all five of them were sitting cross-legged in a circle in the vast, empty middle of the sea. It was a baking hot summer day, and they had gone out there with the intention of attempting a ridiculously elaborate piece of collaborative magic, a 5-person spell that, if it worked, would sharpen their vision and hearing and increase their physical strength for a couple of hours. It was Viking magic, battlefield magic designed for a raiding party, and as far as any of them knew, it hadn't been tried in roughly a millennium. Josh, who was directing their efforts, confessed that he wasn't completely sure it had ever worked in the first place. Those Viking shamans did a lot of empty boasting. They had started drinking early, over lunch, even though Josh said everything was ready at noon. "Done deal, good to go, let's hook it up." By the time he actually gave them their handouts, spiral ring pages of Old Norse chants scratched out in ballpoint in Josh's neat, tiny, runic script, and prepared the ground by pouring out a weaving, branching knot in black sand on the grass, it was almost 4. There was singing involved, and neither Janet nor Quentin could carry a tune, and they kept cracking each other up and having to start over. Finally they got all the way through it, and they sat around staring at the grass and the sky and the backs of their hands and the clock tower in the distance, trying to tell if anything was different. Quentin jogged to the edge of the forest to pee, and when he got back, Janet was talking about somebody named Emily Greenstreet. Don't tell me you knew her, Elliot said.
I didn't, but remember I roomed with that cow Emma Curtis during first year? I was talking to her cousin last week when I was home. She lives near my parents in L.A. She was here then, told me the whole story.
Really? And now you're going to tell us, Josh said. It's all a big secret, though. You can't tell anybody.
Emma wasn't a cow, Josh said. Or if she was, she was a hot cow. She's like one of those Wagyu cows. Did she ever pay you back for that dress she threw up on?
He was lying on his back, staring up into the cloudless sky. He didn't seem to care if the spell had worked or not.
No, she didn't. And now she's gone to Tajikistan or something to save the vanishing Asiatic grasshopper or something. Cow.
Who's Emily Greenstreet? Alice asked.
Emily Greenstreet, Janet said grandly, savoring the rich, satisfying piece of gossip she was about to impart, was the first person to leave Breakbills voluntarily in 150 years.
Her words floated up and drifted away like cigarette smoke in the warm summer air. It was hot out in the middle of the sea, with no shade, but they were all too lazy to move.
She came to Breakbills about 8 years ago. I think she was from Connecticut, but not fancy Connecticut with the money and the Kennedy cousins and the Lyme disease. I think she was from New Haven or Bridgeport. She was quiet, sort of mousy-looking.
How do you know she was mousy-looking? Josh asked.
Psh! Alice whacked Josh on the arm. Don't antagonize her. I want to hear the story.
They were all lying on a stripy blanket spread out over the ruins of Josh's sand pattern.
I know, because Emma's cousin told me. Anyway, it's my story, and if I say she was mousy, then she had a tail and she lived on Swiss fucking cheese. Emily Greenstreet was one of these girls that nobody ever notices, who are only friends with other girls nobody notices. Nobody likes or dislikes them. They have weak chins or chicken pox scars, or their glasses are too big. I know I'm being mean, but, you know, they're just sort of at the edge of everything. She was a good student. She kept busy and got by in her boring little way until her third year, when she finally distinguished herself by falling in love with one of her professors. Everybody does it, of course, or at least the girls do, since we all have daddy complexes, but usually it's just a crush and we get over it and move on to some loser guy our own age. But not our Emily. She was deeply, passionately, delusionally in love, Wuthering Heights love. She stood outside his window at night. She drew little pictures of him in class. She looked at the moon and cried. She drew little pictures of the moon in class and cried at them. She became moody and depressed. She started wearing black and listening to the Smiths and reading Camus in the original whatever. Her eyes became interestingly pouchy and sunken. She started hanging out at Wolf. All groaned. Wolf was a fountain in the maze. Its official name was Van Pelt, after an 18th-century dean, but it depicted Romulus and Remus suckling from a she-wolf with many dangling wolf boobs, hence Wolf. It was the chosen hangout of the goths and the artsy crowd. Now she had a secret, capital S, and ironically, it made her more attractive to people because they wanted to know what her secret was. And sure enough, before long, a boy, some deeply unfortunate boy, fell in love with her. She didn't love this boy back, since she was saving all her lovin' for Professor Sexy Man, but he made her feel pretty damn good, since nobody had ever been in love with her before. She strung him along and flirted with him in public in the hope that it would make her real love interest jealous. Now we turn to the third point in our little triangle of love. By all rights, the professor should have been completely impervious to our Emily's charms. He should have had an avuncular little chuckle over it in the senior common room and then forgotten about it. She wasn't even that hot. Maybe he was having a midlife crisis. Maybe he thought a liaison with Ms. Greenstreet could restore to him some of his long-vanished youth. Who knows? He was married, too, the idiot. We'll never know exactly what happened or how far it went, except that it went too far, and then Professor Sexy Man came to his senses or got what he wanted, and he called it off. Needless to say, our Emily became even gothier and weepier and more like a gory drawing than she already was, and her boy became even more besotted and brought her presents and flowers and was supportive. Maybe you knew this, I don't know, I didn't, but Wolf used to be different from the other fountains. That's why the Doomers started hanging out there in the first place. You wouldn't notice what was off about it at first, but after a while you'd realize that when you looked into it, you wouldn't see your own reflection, just empty sky. And maybe if the sky was cloudy on that particular day, the sky in the fountain would be blue, or the other way around. It definitely wasn't a normal reflection. And every once in a while you'd look into it and you'd see other faces looking up at you, looking puzzled as if they were looking into some other fountain somewhere else and were weirded out because they were seeing your face and not their own. Somebody must have figured out a way to switch the reflections in two fountains. But who did it and why and how and why the dean didn't change them back, I have no idea. You have to wonder, too, if it was more than just the reflections, if you could dive down into one pool and come up in the other one, in this world or some other world. There's always been something off about those fountains. Did you know they were here before Breakbills? They built the school to be near them, and not the other way around. Or that's what people say.
Elliot snorted.
Well, that's what people say, darling. Anyway, Janet went on, the thing is, Emily started spending a lot of time at Wolf, just smoking and hanging out and, I guess, mooning over her little affair. She spent so much time there that she started to recognize one of the faces in the fountain. Somebody like her who was spending a lot of time at the other fountain, the one in the reflection. Let's call her Doris. After a while, Emily and Doris got to noticing each other. They'd acknowledge each other, a little wave, you know, just to be polite. Probably Doris was a little mopey, too. They got to feeling like kindred spirits. Emily and Doris worked out a way to communicate. Again, the exact details have eluded your intrepid correspondent. Maybe they held up signs or something. They must have had to be in mirror writing to make sense as reflections, or am I getting that wrong? I don't know how things worked in Wolfland, where Doris lived. Maybe magic is different there. Or maybe Doris was fucking with our Emily. Maybe she was sick of hearing Emily whine about her love life. Maybe there was something really wrong with Doris. Maybe she was something genuinely evil. But one day, Doris suggested that if Emily wanted her lover back, maybe her appearance was the problem, and she should try changing it.
A chill settled over the group, where they lay on the sun-warm turf. Even Quentin knew that using magic to alter one's physical appearance never ended well. In the world of magical theory, it was a dead spot, something about the inextricable, recursive connection between your face and who you were. Your soul, for lack of a better word, made it hellishly difficult and fatally unpredictable. When Quentin had first gotten to Breakbills, he'd wondered why everybody didn't just make themselves ridiculously good-looking. He'd looked at the kids with an obviously flawed feature, like Gretchen with her leg, or Elliot with his twisted jaw, and wondered why they didn't get somebody to fix them up, like Hermione with her teeth in Harry Potter. But in reality, it always ended in disaster.
"Poor Emily," Janet said. When she took down the spell that Doris taught her through the fountain, she actually thought she'd found it.
the secret technique everybody else had missed. It was elaborate and costly, but it really looked like it might work. After a few weeks of laying the groundwork, she put it together one night by herself in her room. How do you think she felt when she looked in the mirror and saw what she'd done to herself?
You could almost hear a note of genuine sympathy in Janet's hard voice.
I can't imagine. I really can't.
It was late enough in the afternoon now that the shadows from the forest had almost stretched out from the western edge of the sea far enough to lap at the edge of their blanket. Must have been she could still talk, because she got word to her boy that she was in trouble, and he came to her room, and after much preliminary whispering through the keyhole, she let him in. And we have to give our boy credit. It must have been bad, very bad, but he stuck by her. She wouldn't let him go to the faculty. Dunleavy was still dean, and she would have kicked Emily out without thinking about it. So he told her to stay there, don't move, don't do anything to make it worse. He would go to the library and see what he could find. He came back just before dawn, thinking he had it pretty much worked out. You can imagine the scene. They'd both been up all night. They're sitting cross-legged on her little bed, her with her scrambled head, him with about 8 books open around him on the covers. He's mixed up a few reagents in cereal bowls from the dining hall. She's leaning what's left of her forehead against the wall, trying to keep cool. The blue in the window is getting brighter and brighter. They've got to take care of this soon. She'd probably gone past panic and regret at this point, but not past hope. But then think about his state of mind. In a way, for him, it was the perfect thing to have happen. This is his golden moment, his chance to be the hero, to save her and win her love, or at least some pity sex. It's his chance to be strong for her, which is the only thing he's ever wanted to do. But I don't know. I think he'd had enough time at this point. Maybe he'd figured out what was really going on. I'm guessing the dime had finally dropped. She'd taken a terrible chance, and he had to know she hadn't done it for him. Either way, he was in no shape to be doing major wizardry. He was tired and scared and in over his head, and I think his heart must have been broken a little too. Maybe he just wanted it too badly. He launched into the repair spell, which I happen to know which one it was. It was from the Major Arcana Renaissance stuff. Big energies. It got away from him in the worst possible way. It took him over, took his body away, right in front of her eyes. He burned up, screaming, blue fire. He became a Niffin. That's what Fogg was talking about that night in the infirmary, Quentin thought, about losing control. Apparently the others knew what the word meant, Niffin. They stared at Janet like they'd been turned to stone. Well, Emily freaked out, I mean freaked out, barricaded the door, wouldn't let anybody in until her beloved professor himself showed up. By that point, the whole school was awake. I can only imagine how he felt, since in a way the whole thing was his fault. He can't have been too proud of himself. I suppose he would have had to try to banish the Niffin if it didn't want to leave. I don't know if even he could have. I don't think those things really have an upper limit. Anyway, he kept his head, kept everybody else out of the room. He put her face back, right there on the spot, which cannot have been easy. Whatever else he was, he must have been some magician, because that spell that came through the fountain, that was a nasty piece of work, and she probably twisted it up even more in the casting, too. But he parsed it on the fly and made her reasonably presentable, though I hear she's never been quite the way she was. Not like she's deformed or anything, just different. Probably if you hadn't met her, you would never know. And that's pretty much it. I can't even imagine what they told the boy's parents. I hear he was from a magical family, so they probably got some version of the truth.
But, you know, the clean version. There was a long silence. A bell was clanging far away, a boat on the river. The shadow from the trees had flooded all the way over them, deliciously cool in the late summer afternoon. Alice cleared her throat.
What happened to the professor?
You haven't figured it out?
Janet didn't bother to conceal her glee.
They gave him a choice. Resign in disgrace, or transfer to Antarctica. Break bills south. Guess which one he took.
Oh, my God, Josh said. It was Mayakovsky.
That explains a hell of a lot, Quentin said.
Doesn't it, though? Doesn't it just?
So what happened to Emily Greenstreet?
Alice asked. She just left school? There was a trace of ground steel in her voice. Quentin wasn't totally sure where it was coming from.
What happened to her? Did they send her to a normal school?
I hear she does something businessy in Manhattan, Janet said. They set her up with an easy corporate job. I don't know, management consulting or something. We own part of some big firm. Lots of magic to cover up the fact that she doesn't do anything. She just sits in an office and surfs the web all day. I think part of her just didn't survive what happened, you know? After that, even Janet stopped talking. Quentin let himself drift among the clouds. He felt spinny from the wine, like the earth had come untightened and was wobbling loose on its gimbaled base. Apparently, he wasn't the only one, because when Josh stood up after a few minutes, he immediately lost his balance and fell over again on the turf. There was scattered applause. But then he stood up again, steadied himself, did a slow, deep knee bend, and executed a perfect standing backflip. He stuck the landing and straightened up, beaming.
"It worked," he said. "I can't believe it. I take back everything bad I ever said about Viking shamans. It fucking worked."
The spell had worked, though for some reason Josh was the only one who got anything out of it. As they picked up the picnic things and shook the sand out of the blanket, Josh did laps around the field, whooping and making huge superhero leaps in the fading light.
"I am a Viking warrior! Cower before my might! Cower! The strength of Thor and all his mighty hosts flows through me, and I fucked your mother! I fucked your mother!"
"He's so happy," Elliot said dryly. "It's like he cooked something and it came out looking like the picture in the cookbook." Eventually, Josh disappeared in search of other people to show off to, loudly singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Janet and Elliot straggled off in the direction of the cottage, Alice and Quentin toward the house, sunburnt and sleepy and still half-drunk. Quentin had already made up his mind to nap through dinner. "He's going to hurt somebody," he said, "probably himself."
"There's some damage resistance built in, strengthening the skin and the skeleton. He could put his fist through a wall and probably not break anything."
"Probably. If he can, he will."
Alice was even more quiet than usual. It wasn't until they were deep in the twilight alleys of the maze that Quentin saw that her face was slick with tears. His heart went cold.
"Alice? Alice, sweetheart?"
He stopped and turned her to face him.
"What is it?"
She pressed her face miserably into his shoulder.
"Why did she have to tell that story?" she said. Why is she like that?"
Quentin immediately felt guilty for having enjoyed it.
It was a horrible story. But there was something irresistibly gothic about it, too. "She's just a gossip," he said. "She doesn't mean anything." "Doesn't she?" She pulled back, fiercely wiping her tears with the backs of her hands. "Doesn't she? I always thought my brother died in a car crash."
"Your brother?" Quentin froze.
"I don't understand. He was 8 years older than me. My parents told me he died in a car crash. But that was him. I'm sure it was."
"I don't understand. You think he was that boy in the story?"
She nodded.
"I think he was. I know he was."
Her eyes were red and rubbed with rage and hurt.
"Jesus. Look, it's just a story. There's no way she could know."
"She knows." Alice kept walking.
"It all works out, the timing of it. And he was like that. Charlie, he was always falling in love with people. He would have tried to save her himself. He would have done that."
She shook her head bitterly.
"He was stupid that way." "Maybe she didn't know. Maybe Janet didn't realize it was him."
"That's what she wants everybody to think. So you won't realize what a howling cunt she is."
Howling was a big word at Brakebills that year. Quentin was about to keep defending Janet when something else clicked.
"That's why you weren't invited here," he said quietly.
"It has to be. Because of what happened to your brother."
She nodded, her eyes unfocused now, her relentless brain chewing away at this wrinkle, fitting other things into the bleak new picture it created.
"They didn't want anything to happen to me. As if it would. God, why is everybody else in the world but us so fucking stupid?"
They stopped a few yards short of the edge of the maze, in the deep shadow that pooled where the hedges grew close together, as if they couldn't face the daylight again, not quite yet.
"At least now I know," she said.
"But why did she tell that story, Q? She knew it would hurt me. Why would she do that?" He shook his head. The idea of conflict within their little clique made him uncomfortable. He wanted to explain it away. He wanted everything to be perfect.
"She's just bitter," he said finally, "because you're the pretty one."
Alice snorted. "She's bitter because we're happy," she said, "and she's in love with Elliot. Always has been, and he doesn't love her." She started walking again.
"What? Wait."
Quentin shook his head, as if that would make all the pieces fit together again.
"Why would she want Elliot?"
"Because she can't have him," Alice said bitterly, without looking back at him.
"And she has to have everything? I'm surprised she hasn't come after you. What, you think she hasn't slept with Josh?"
They left the maze and climbed the stairs to the rear terrace, lit by the yellow light coming through the French doors and littered with premature autumn leaves. Alice cleaned herself up as best she could with the heels of her hands. She didn't wear much makeup anyway. Quentin stood by and silently handed her tissues to blow her nose with, adrift in his own thoughts. It never failed to astonish him, then or ever, how much of the world around him was mysterious and hidden from view. Fifth Year. Then September came, and it was just Quentin and Alice. The others were gone, in a swirl of falling leaves and a crackle of early frost. It was a shock to see them go, but along with the shock, mixed in with it like the liquor in a cocktail, was an even greater feeling of relief. Quentin wanted things to be good between them, to be better than good, to be perfect. But perfection is a nervy business, because the moment you spot the tiniest flaw, it's ruined.
Perfection was part of Quentin's mythology of Brakebills, the story he told himself about his life there, a narrative as carefully constructed and reverently maintained as Fillory and Further. And he wanted to be able not just to tell it to himself, but to believe it. That had been getting progressively more difficult. Pressure was building up in some subterranean holding tank, and right at the end there, things had begun to come apart. Even Quentin, with his almost limitless capacity for ignoring the obvious, had begun to pick up on it. Maybe Alice was right. Maybe Janet really did hate her and love Elliot. Maybe it was something else, something so glaringly obvious that Quentin couldn't stand to look at it directly. One way or another, the bonds that held them together were starting to fray. They were losing their magical ability to effortlessly love one another. Now, even though things would never be the same, even though they'd never be together in the same way, at least he could always remember it the way he wanted to. The memories were safe, sealed forever in amber. As soon as the semester began, Quentin did something he had already put off for much too long. He went to Dean Fogg and told him what had happened to Julia. Fogg just frowned and told him he'd take care of it. Quentin wanted to climb across the desk and grab Fogg by his natty lapels for what he'd done to her by screwing up the memory spells. He tried to explain to Fogg that he had made Julia suffer in a way that nobody should ever have to suffer. Fogg just watched, neither moved nor unmoved. In the end, the best Quentin could do was to make him promise that he would strain whatever the applicable regulations were to the breaking point to make things easier for her. It was all he could think of. He left Fogg's office feeling exactly as bad as he had when he entered it. Sitting at dinner or strolling between classes through the dusty hallways full of sideways afternoon light, Quentin began to realize for the first time how cut off from the rest of the school he and Alice had been for the past 2 years, and how few of the other students he really knew. All the groups were cliques unto themselves, but the physical kids had been especially tight, and now he and Alice were all that was left of them. He still had classes with the other 5th years, and he chatted with them in a friendly way, but he knew that their loyalties and their attention were elsewhere. "I bet they think we're horrible snobs," Alice said one day, "the way we keep to ourselves." They were sitting on the cool stone rim of the fountain known as Sammy, a knockoff of the Laocoon in Rome, serpents strangling the renegade priest and his sons, but with water squirting cheerfully out of everybody's mouths. They had come out to try a piece of messy domestic magic for removing stains from a skirt of Alice's that was best performed outdoors, but they'd forgotten a key ingredient, turmeric, and weren't ready to face the walk back yet. It was a beautiful fall Saturday morning, or really it was closer to noon. The temperature balanced precariously on the tipping point between warm and chilly. "You think so? Don't you?" "No, you're probably right," he sighed. "They probably do, uncharitable bastards. They're the snobs." Alice tossed an acorn overhand at the fountain. It ticked off one of the dying priest's sturdy knees and into the water. "Do you think we are? Snobs, I mean?" Quentin asked. "I don't know. Not necessarily. No, I don't think we are. We have nothing against them." "Exactly. Some of them are perfectly fine." "Some of them we hold in the highest esteem." "Exactly." Quentin dabbled his fingertips in the water. "So what are you saying? We should go out and make friends?" She shrugged. "They're the only other magicians our age on the continent. They're the only peers we'll ever have." The sky was burning blue, and the tree branches stood out sharply against it in the clear, shivering reflection in the fountain. "Okay," Quentin said, "but not with all of them." "Well, God, no. We'll be discriminating. Anyway, who even knows if they'll want to be friends with us?"
"Right.
So, who? Does it matter?
Of course it matters, Vix, Quentin said. It's not like they're all the same. Vix was a term of endearment with them, short for vixen, an allusion to their Antarctic interlude, vixen being the word for a female fox. So, who?
Surendra.
Okay, sure. Or no, he's going out with that horrible second year, you know, with the teeth. She's always trying to make people do madrigals after dinner. What about Georgia?
Maybe we're overthinking this. We can't force it. We'll just let it happen naturally.
Okay.
Quentin watched her study her nails with her intense, bird-like focus. Sometimes she looked so beautiful he couldn't believe she had anything to do with him. He could barely believe she existed at all.
But you have to do it, she said. If it's me, nothing's going to happen. You know I'm pathetic at that kind of thing.
I know. She threw an acorn at him.
You weren't supposed to agree.
And so, with a concerted effort, they roused themselves from their stupor and embarked on a belated campaign to socialize with the rest of their class, most of whom they'd drifted almost completely out of touch with. In the end, it wasn't Surendra or Georgia, but Gretchen, the blonde girl who walked with a cane, who turned out to be the key. It helped that Alice and Gretchen were both prefects, which was a source of both pride and embarrassment to them. The position carried with it almost no official duties. Mostly it was just yet another absurd, infantilizing idea borrowed from the English public school system, a symptom of the Anglophilia that was embedded so deeply in the institutional DNA of breakbills. Prefectships were given to the four students in the fourth and fifth years with the highest GPA, who then got, or had, to wear a silver pin in the shape of a bee on their jackets. Their actual responsibilities were petty things like regulating access to the single phone on campus, an obsolete rotary monster hidden away in a battle-scarred wooden phone booth that was itself tucked away under a back staircase, which always had a line a dozen students long. In return, they had access to the prefect's common room, a special locked lounge on the east side of the house with a high, handsome, arched window and a cabinet that was always stocked with sticky sweet sherry that Quentin and Alice forced themselves to drink. The prefect's common room was also an excellent place to have sex in, as long as they could square it with the other prefects in advance. But that usually wasn't a problem. Gretchen was sympathetic, since she had a boyfriend of her own, and the third prefect was a popular girl with spiky blonde hair named Beatrice, whom nobody had even realized was especially smart before she was named a prefect. She never used the room anyway. The only real trick was avoiding the fourth prefect, because the fourth prefect was, of all people, Penny. The announcement that Penny was a prefect was so universally, gobsmackingly surprising that nobody talked about anything else for the rest of the day. Quentin had barely spoken to Penny since their infamous altercation, not that he'd gone looking for him. From that day on, Penny had become a loner, a ghost, which was not an easy thing to be at a school as small as Breakbill's, but he had a talent for it. He walked quickly between classes with a flat, frozen stare on his round, frying-pan face, bolted his food at mealtimes, went on long, solitary rambles, stayed in his room in the afternoons after class, went to bed early, got up at dawn. What else he did, nobody knew. When the Breakbill students were sorted into groups by discipline at the end of second year, Penny wasn't assigned to a group at all. The rumor was that he had tested into a discipline so arcane and outlandish it couldn't be classified according to any of the conventional schemes. Whether it was true or not, next to his name on the official list, Fogg had simply put the word independent. He rarely turned up in class after that, and when he did, he lurked silently in the back of the room with his hands shoved in the pockets of his fraying Breakbill's blazer, never asking questions, never taking notes. He had an air of knowing things other people didn't. He was sometimes seen in the company of Professor Vandeveer,
under whose guidance he was rumored to be pursuing an intensive independent study. The prefect's common room was an increasingly important refuge for Quentin and Alice because their old sanctuary, the cottage, was no longer sacrosanct. Quentin had never really thought about it, but it was pure chance that last year nobody knew had been placed in the physical group, thus preserving the integrity of their little clique. But the drought was bound to come to an end, and it did. At the end of the previous semester, no fewer than 4 rising third years had tested into physical, and now, although it seemed wrong in every possible way, they had as much right to the cottage as Quentin and Alice did. They did their best to be good sports about it. On the first day of classes, they sat patiently in the library as the new physical kids went through the ritual and broke into the cottage. They debated long and earnestly about what to serve the newcomers when they came in, finally settling on a goodish champagne and, not wanting to be selfish, even though that was exactly how they felt, an obscenely expensive array of oysters and caviar with toast points and creme fraiche. "Cool," the new physical kids said, one after the other, as they made their way inside. They goggled at the oversized interior. They inspected the bric-a-brac and the piano and the cabinet of alphabetized twigs. They looked impossibly young. Quentin and Alice made small talk with them, trying to be witty and knowing, the way they remembered the others having been when they first got there. Sitting in a row on the couch, the third years squirmed and sipped their champagne too quickly, like children waiting to be excused. They asked polite questions about the paintings and the cottage library. Do the books circulate outside the building? Did they really have a first edition ABC Darian Arcana in the hand of Pseudo-Dionysius himself? Really? And when was the cottage first constructed? Really? Wow, that's old. That's like ancient. Then, after a suitable interval, they disappeared en masse into the pool room. They showed no particular desire to be chaperoned there, and Quentin and Alice had no particular desire ever to see them again, so they stayed where they were. As the evening wore on, the sounds of adolescent bonding could be heard. It became apparent to Quentin and Alice that they were relics of an earlier era that had worn out its welcome. They had come full circle. They were outsiders again. "I feel like an elderly docent," Quentin said. "I already forget their names," Alice said. "They're like quadruplets." "We should give them numbers, tell them it's a tradition. And then we could always call them by the wrong number, freak them out, or we could call them all the same thing, Alfred or something. Even the girls? Especially the girls." They were sipping tepid leftover champagne. They were getting drunk, but Quentin didn't care. From the pool room came the glittery tinkle of breaking glass, a champagne flute, probably. And then, a little later, the sound of a sash being raised and somebody throwing up, hopefully, out the window. "The problem with growing up," Quentin said, "is that once you're grown up, people who aren't grown up aren't fun anymore." "We should have burned this place down," Alice said gloomily. They were definitely drunk. "Been the last ones out the door and then torched it. Then walked away with it burning behind us in the background like in a movie. End of an era, end of an epoch. Which one, era or epoch? What's the difference?" Quentin didn't know. They would have to find something else, he thought mazily. Something new. Couldn't stay here anymore. Couldn't go back, only forward. "Do you think we were ever like this?" Quentin asked. "Like these kids?" "Probably. I bet we were even worse. I don't know how the others put up with us." "You're right," he said. "You're right. God, they were so much nicer than we are." That winter, Quentin didn't go home for the holidays. Around Christmas time, real world Christmas,
He'd had the usual conversation with his parents about Brakeville's unusual schedule, which he had to remind them about every year, lounging inside the old phone booth under the back stairs with one foot braced up against the folding wooden door. Then, by the time Brakeville's calendar Christmas rolled around, it was already March in the real world, and it didn't seem like such a big deal not to go back. If they had asked him, if they'd put it out there for an instant that they were eager to see him, or that they would be disappointed if he didn't come, he might have caved. He would have, in a second. But they were their usual blithe, oblivious, glassine selves. And besides, he got an independent feeling from coolly informing them that he had other plans, thanks very much. Instead, Quentin went home with Alice. It was her idea, though as it got closer to the holidays, Quentin wasn't exactly sure why she'd invited him, since the prospect obviously made her suicidally uncomfortable.
I don't know, she said when he asked her. It just seemed like the kind of things boyfriends and girlfriends do.
Well, whatever, I don't have to come. I'll just stay here, just say I had a paper to finish or something. I'll see you in January.
But don't you want to come? She wailed.
Of course I do. I want to see where you come from. I want your parents to know who I am. And God knows I'm not taking you back to my parents' house.
All right.
She didn't sound any less anxious.
Do you promise to hate my parents as much as I do?
Oh, absolutely, Quentin said. Maybe even more. The opening of the portals home for vacation was always a complicated and tedious procedure that inevitably led to huge numbers of Brakebillians backed up with all their luggage in a ragged line that wound down the dark, narrow corridor leading to the main living room, where Professor Vanderveer was in charge of getting people where they needed to go. Everybody was relieved that exams were over, and there was always a lot of giddy pushing and shoving and shrieking and casting of minor pyrotechnic spells. Quentin and Alice waited together in silence with their packed bags, solemnly, side by side, Quentin looking as respectable as he could manage. He hardly had any clothes anymore that weren't part of his Brakeville's uniform. He knew Alice was from Illinois, and he knew Illinois was in the Midwest. But he couldn't have pointed to the precise location of that state within 1,000 miles. Apart from a European vacation in junior high, he'd barely ever been off the East Coast, and his Brakeville's education hadn't done much to improve his grasp of American geography. And as it turned out, he hardly saw Illinois anyway, or at least not its exterior. Professor Vanderveer set up the portal to open directly into an anteroom inside Alice's parents' house. Stone walls, flat mosaic floors, post and lintel doorways on all sides, it was a precise recreation of a traditional bourgeois Roman residence. Sound echoed in it like a church. It was like stepping past the red velvet rope at a museum. Magic tended to run in families. Quentin was an exception in that respect, and Alice's parents were both magicians. She had never had to sneak around behind their backs the way he had to with his parents. "Welcome to the house that time forgot to forget," Alice said sulkily, kicking her bags into a corner. She led him by the hand along an alarmingly long, dark corridor to a sunken living room with cushions and hard Roman-style couches strewn around at careless angles and a modest, plashing fountain in the middle. "Daddy changes it all around every few years," she explained. "He mostly does architectural magic. When I was little, it was all Baroque, gold knobs on everything. That was almost nice. But then it was Japanese paper screens. You could hear everything. Then it was falling water, Frank Lloyd Wright, until Mom got sick of living in a mildew farm for some reason. And then for a while it was just a big old Iroquois longhouse with a dirt floor, no walls. That was hilarious. We had to beg him to put in a real bathroom. I think he seriously thought we were going to watch him defecate into a pit. I doubt even the Indians did that."
With that, she sat down heavily on a hard leather Roman couch, opened a book, and became absorbed in her vacation reading. Quentin understood that it was sometimes better to wait out Alice's black periods than to try to coax her out of them. Everybody has their own idiopathic reaction to their childhood home. So he spent the next hour wandering around what looked remarkably like an upper-middle-class Pompeian household, complete with pornographic frescoes. It was obsessively authentic, except for the bathrooms. A concession had obviously been granted on that score. Even dinner, when it arrived, served by a squad of 3-foot-tall animated wooden marionettes who made little click-clacking noises as they walked, was revoltingly historical. Calf brains, parrot tongues, a roasted moray eel, all peppered beyond the point of edibility, just in case they weren't inedible to begin with. Fortunately, there was plenty of wine. They had progressed to the third course, the stuffed and roasted uterus of a sow, when a short, portly, round-faced man suddenly appeared in the doorway. He was dressed in a well-worn toga, the gray of unlaundered bedsheets. He hadn't shaved for several days, and his dark stubble extended well down his neck, and what hair he had left on his head could have used cutting. "Ave atque vales," he proclaimed. He gave an elaborate, made-up-looking Roman salute, which was essentially the same as a Nazi salute. "Welcome to the Domus of Danielus." He made a face that implied that it was the other people's fault that the joke wasn't funny.
"Hi, Dad," Alice said. "Dad, this is my friend Quentin."
"Hi," Quentin stood up. He'd been trying to eat reclining, Roman style, but it was harder than it looked, and he had a stitch in his side. Alice's father shook his outstretched hand. He seemed to forget he was doing it halfway through, then looked surprised to find a fleshy, alien extremity still in his grip.
"Are you really eating that stuff? I had Domino's an hour ago."
"We didn't know there was anything else. Where's Mom?"
"Who knows?" Alice's father said. He bugged his eyes out like it was a wacky mystery. "She was working on one of her compositions downstairs last I saw."
He jogged the few steps down into the room, sandals slapping the stone tiles, and served himself some wine from a decanter.
"And that was when? November?"
"Don't ask me. I lose track of time in this damn place."
"Why don't you put in some windows, Daddy? It's so dark in here."
"Windows?"
He bugged out his eyes again. It appeared to be his signature facial expression.
"You speak of some barbarian magic of which we noble Romans know nothing."
"You've done an amazing job here," Quentin piped up, the soul of obsequiousness. "It looks really authentic."
"Thank you,"
Alice's father drained the goblet and poured himself another, then sat down heavily on a couch, spilling a purple track of wine down the front of his toga in the process. His bare calves were plump and bone-white. Black bristles stood straight out from them in static astonishment. Quentin wondered how his beautiful Alice could possibly share a single base pair of genetic information with this person.
"It took me 3 years to put it together," he said. "3 years. And you know what? I'm already sick of it after 2 months. I can't eat the food, there are skid marks on my toga, and I have plantar fasciitis from walking around on these stone floors. What is the point of my life?"
He looked at Quentin furiously, as if he actually expected an answer, as if Quentin were concealing it from him.
"Would someone tell me that, please? Because I have no idea. None."
Alice glared at her father like he'd just killed her pet. Quentin stayed perfectly still, as if that meant that Alice's father, like a dinosaur, couldn't see him. They all three sat in awkward silence for a long beat. Then he stood up.
"Gracias, and good night."
He tossed the train of his toga over his shoulder and strode out of the room. The marionette's feet clack-clacked on the stone floor as they mopped up the spilled wine he left behind.
"That's my dad," Alice said loudly, and rolled her eyes as if she expected a laugh track to kick in behind her. None did.
In the midst of this domestic wasteland, Alice and Quentin established a workable, even comfortable routine for themselves, invaders staking out a safe perimeter deep in hostile territory. It was weirdly